that music didn't really have anything to do to relate to our topic today. Most of you know we try to make a tie-in. But no music would even begin to touch this topic because it's devastating, it's intriguing, it's unbelievable. But ultimately, it's going to bring the truth in and turn the world upside down. I'm having a bit of trouble talking today. I caught something in my throat. My throat's a bit sore. The show is Sound Health. I'm your host, Sherry Edwards. Thank you for joining us. Today, our guest is John Perkins. He's going to be with us for the next half hour. He's the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman and the Secret History of the American Empire. When I read his first book, I was absolutely terrified, but it opened my eyes to a side of human behavior that I just didn't want to believe. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sherry. It's great to be with you.
From what I've read in your books, you should be a dead man. How did you ever get the courage to get these books out?
Well, you know, I talk about that in Secret History a bit, and that after I stopped being an economic hitman, I started to write confessions a number of times back in the 80s. But each time I contacted other former economic hitmen or current economic hitmen and jackals, those are the people who, when we economic hitmen fail, will assassinate leaders. When we fail to corrupt them, the jackals will go in and assassinate or overthrow them. I contacted people like this in order to get their stories in the book. And as a result, I was then offered bribes and threatened with my life and the life of my daughter, who was young at the time. She's 25 now. And so I took these threats very seriously. I had seen what could happen to people. And I accepted the bribes. I put the money toward good use, creating nonprofit organizations like Dream Change and the Pachamama Alliance, which you can go to their websites and find out more about them. But nonetheless, I deferred from writing. I didn't write the books. And then after 9/11, I went to Ground Zero. And when I stood there seeing what had happened there, I knew I had to write the books. I knew that the American people deserved and needed to understand why so much of the world is angry at us. This isn't to condone mass murder at 9/11 at all, but it is to say I knew that I had to tell my story. People needed to understand a lot more about our foreign policy. And at that time, I also made a commitment to myself that I would not contact anyone else. I would write the book alone, which made it more difficult, but also safer. And that I wouldn't tell anybody, even my wife and daughter, what book I was working on until the manuscript was completed in the hands of my very, very competent New York agent, and he sent it out to a number of major publishing houses. At that point, the manuscript became my greatest insurance policy. Any good jackal knows that if they had killed me at that point, or if they should do so now for that matter, the book will sell many, many, many millions more copies than it already has sold and will have a much greater impact on people.
Well, it's a very poignant, well-written, very graceful, easily readable book. I want everybody to go out and buy it because I want everybody to wake up. Is that kind of the idea that you had?
Well, it is. We, in since World War II, and especially in the last couple of decades, have managed to create the world's first truly global empire that's been created without the military, primarily. This empire has been created by economic hitmen like me, without the military for the most part. And therefore, it's really been created in secret. When you send your military out to conquer other lands, as the Spaniards did, and the Portuguese, and the French, and the English, and many other empire builders before, everyone knows you're doing it. But the way we've done it has been very surreptitious, very clandestine. And so most of us living in the United States don't really realize that we are reaping the fruits of a vast empire that's based to a large degree on tremendous servitude, even slavery and deep poverty around the world. And that's a set policy. We don't realize that. And we need to change it. Because we don't realize it, it's even hard to make the argument that we're truly a democracy. A democracy is based on an informed electorate. And if so many people in our country don't understand one of the basic tenets of our foreign policy, then it's hard to say that we're truly an informed electorate. So in writing the book, I wanted to get people informed. I wanted people to understand what's going on. And most Americans are appalled by what's truly going on. And once we know about it, we then can set out to change it and create the kind of world that we want to pass on to our children and grandchildren.
When I'm reading this, it talks about, these are my words, economic rape. But there's also rape of people's cultures. There's rape of their land. There's rape of their ethics, the morals. It's just incredible. Are you going to make a movie out of this?
Well, the movie rights, the option to the movie rights has been purchased by Harrison Ford and Beacon Films of one of the Disney companies. And so they, right now it's up to them whether they decide to move forward with it as a movie or not. I have no control over that.
Oh, can we call them up and say, this has to come out?
By all means.
How did you ever find a publisher that would go along with this? It looks like the publishers would be afraid of you.
Well, they were. In fact, I have a very stalwart agent who personally wanted to see the book published because the story rang true to him. And he has a son that's the same age as my daughter, who is now 25. And he felt it was very important to future generations. And he told me from the start it would be difficult. The book was turned down by 29 publishers, including all the majors in the United States, and finally picked up by a very courageous independent publishing house in San Francisco, Barrett Kohler. And Barrett Kohler published a hardcover edition, and it went on to the New York Times bestseller list. In fact, it's been there for over 70 weeks. And as a result of that, then all the other publishers that had been afraid of it before went into a bidding war to buy the paperback rights from Barrett Kohler. It was interesting that, you know, they were afraid of it when they didn't know how popular it would be, but once it became a bestseller and was making a lot of money, suddenly they weren't nearly as afraid of it anymore. You know, it's a good capitalistic way. If it makes money, you can deal with a lot of fear as long as you're getting rich in the process, and the publishers did get rich in the process. So Penguin bought the paperback rights to Confessions, and Penguin also then signed a contract with me to publish the follow-up, which is The Secret History of the American Empire.
If someone just reads the preface, 4 or 5 pages, of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, they'll be hooked. I'd like to read a little blurb from that. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency of International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations in the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools, including fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I know, I should know, I was an economic hitman. Do you have a quick definition of this terrifying position you were on in as an economic hitman?
Well, yeah, I think you could say that we have been the people who really created a global empire without the military for the most part. We work many different ways, but perhaps the most common is that we'll identify a third world country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from an organization like the World Bank. That money, however, doesn't go to the country. Instead, it goes to our own corporations and pays them to build big infrastructure projects in that country, like hydroelectric plants, power lines, industrial parks, highways, things that benefit our corporations that build them, and also a few rich people in those countries, collaborators, but do not help the majority of the people, the poor people who can't afford much electricity, they don't use highways, and don't have the skills to get jobs in industrial parks. But they and the whole country are left holding a huge debt. And so this debt is so big that at some point we go back and say to the country, listen, you owe us a lot of money, can't pay your debt, so give us a pound of flesh. Sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies, or vote with us on the next critical United Nations vote, or send troops in support of ours to someplace in the world like Iraq, or allow us to build a military base on your soil. And in that way, we've really, and very subtly, created this empire, put these people under our control. So we've used World Bank money to enrich our corporations, and at the same time, put these countries deep into so much debt that they have to pay off with favors. And when we fail, when we economic hitmen fail, when we cannot bring one of these country leaders around, as I failed to do with Omar Torrijos in Panama and Jaime Roldos in Ecuador, I talk about this in the books, these men refuse to be corrupted. When we fail to corrupt these leaders, then the jackals are sent in to either overthrow the governments, as they did with Salvador Allende, with Arbenz of Guatemala, with so many others, or to assassinate them, which is what happened to, in the case where I failed, with Jaime Roldos of Ecuador and Omar Torrijos of Panama. They were both assassinated.
In both of your books, it just is absolutely evident that your ideals are closely aligned with those of the founding fathers. And you grew up believing in the morals and ideas of the Constitution and fairness. What? Did you make a slip? Did you just kind of ooze into it? Boy, how did you get from your upbringing to this?
That's a great question, Shari. I was raised a very conservative New England. I came from New Hampshire, Yankee, Calvinist, Republican. Amongst my ancestors, I count Tom Paine as a very distant relative, and Ethan Allen, another Revolutionary War heroes. My family's fought in every major war the United States has ever fought in. And when I graduated from business school, I was basically recruited by the National Security Agency into the ranks of economic hitmen. Now, they spent a great deal of time telling me that what I was doing was not illegal. And in fact, it isn't illegal. Nothing I did was illegal. And that what I was doing was arranging these loans for these countries and building big infrastructure projects which would increase the overall economics, the economic growth of the country, the gross national product or gross domestic product. And in fact, it did do that. And so it was easy to justify. And Harvard and other major universities invited me in to lecture about what I was doing. Robert McNamara, president of the World Bank, patted me on the back. It was very easy to convince myself that what I was doing was right. What, though, I began to see more and more was that even though we might be increasing the overall economics of the country, we were also greatly increasing the gap between the rich and the poor. And only a very few very rich people were benefiting from this economic growth. So it was really contrary to what we said we were doing, which was raising the poor people up by their bootstraps. We weren't doing that at all. We were doing just the opposite. And over time, I saw this more and more clearly. I struggled with my conscience throughout. And then finally, after I'd been an economic hitman for about 10 years, I had an epiphany. I, at this point, had 50 people working for me, doing this kind of work for me. And I really had a moment of enlightenment and determined that I would never do it again.
Well, I don't think I have ever read a book that slapped me around as much as yours did, and you're an incredible writer, and I just felt like you continuously presented the truth that threw buckets of cold water on me and then set me on fire in an attempt to wake me up. So that's my description of your book. You know, a lot of people who are listening to the show on VBS Radio think there's a conspiracy in the world by some world order group that dates back decades, but you talk about this in your book as something that's been set up so people can go that direction. That's not really the case. Can you talk about that?
Well, I have no evidence that there's that kind of a conspiracy as such. You know, we define conspiracy as a group of people getting together to do something illegal and basically meeting in clandestine locations to do this. I don't think that happens. At least I'm not aware of it. But this whole system is set up to be done legally. We write the laws, so why wouldn't we just write into the laws things that make plunder and rape and extortion basically legal, which is what we've done with international banking laws and international financial laws. So it's not really a conspiracy. I liken it more to what went on in the old South, the pre-Civil War South, with the plantation owners. They all knew what it took to keep their economy running in their plantations. It took slavery. And they didn't have to get together and plot to do anything illegal in order to recognize that they needed to do whatever they needed to do to keep slavery in place, including eventually going to war, breaking away, seceding from the Republic. Even that wasn't illegal. That was a legal act on their part, as they saw it. And I think we're very much in that situation now. This thing is really run by the big corporations, what I call the corporatocracy, the men in few women who run our biggest corporations and often also hold high positions in government for a few years. They go back and forth. And they don't really need to get together and conspire to do illegal acts. They know that the basis for their corporations is to create huge profits, make a few wealthy people a lot wealthier, regardless of the environmental and social costs. And they don't really need to do anything illegal or conspiratorial to make that happen. We need to turn that around, nonetheless. Even if it's not illegal, it's certainly terribly immoral, and it's against all of our best interests. You know, what we all want is to bring our children up in a sustainable, stable, socially just world. And this is not happening. We're creating a very dangerous world in many, many ways. And we really must turn this whole thing around, Sherry. And that's why I wrote the book and why I'm writing books now that talk a lot more about what we all need to do, you and I, your listeners, to turn this around, to change it.
Well, we're going to talk about that right at the end of the show. I have a couple of questions I'd like to get in, and some things I want, quotes. This is a wonderful quote from your book. Global culture is a monstrous machine that requires exponentially increasing amounts of fuel and maintenance, so much that it, in the end, will have consumed everything in sight and will be left with no choice but to devour itself. That's what you're talking about. That's where we are today.
Yeah.
So this whole thing is about to devour itself. Our listeners like stories, and I'm going to suggest one, and then you can pick whatever you choose. But what you wrote about with Kermit Roosevelt and what he was sent in to do and how that ultimately ended up, that's such a perfect example of what you're talking about in work. But if you have another story that exemplifies what you're talking about,
There's a lot like that, but I think Kermit is an interesting one, because really he was the first economic hitman. And this is back in the early 50s when a guy named Mossadegh was a democratically elected president of Iran. Very, very popular. And a real Democrat. And he, with a small d, he was Time Magazine's Man of the Year in 1951 and was held out as being the hope for democracy around the world. But he said, you know, Iranian oil ought to profit the Iranian people. And he threatened to clamp down on foreign oil companies, especially British and later U.S. oil companies. And so we decided he had to go, despite the fact he was democratically elected. The early 50s, and Iran was on the border with Russia, who is now our number one enemy. And both of us were nuclear powers, and we feared nuclear war terribly. Few people may remember, as I do, all the scares over nuclear war, and we used to climb under our desks at school when alarms went off as practice for nuclear invasion. We were terrified of nuclear war, so we didn't want to go to war with Russia, but we wanted to get rid of Mossadegh. So we sent in Kermit Roosevelt, who was Teddy Roosevelt's grandson, and with a few million dollars. Roosevelt was a card-carrying CIA agent at the time, and he went in and he bought off people, and he paid for strikes and protests and huge movements out in the streets of Tehran, and eventually he overthrew this democratically elected president, replaced him with the Shah. And it was so successful that the people in Washington realized that this was a new way of owning countries, basically, that you could do it without war. You would do it a lot safer and a lot cheaper. The only problem here was that Roosevelt was a CIA agent. If he had been caught, the government would have been implicated. So the decision was made soon after that to use people like me, private consultants who didn't actually work directly for the government. Our companies were hired under government contracts, but I never worked directly for the government. I was paid by my company, Charles T. Maine of Boston, so that if I was caught, the government wouldn't be implicated. This would just look like some corrupt U.S. consultant going in there to do that. And, you know, I think that point, Shari, brings up a number of really interesting aspects here. One is it tells the story of economic hitmen, but also you really got to wonder, what if instead of taking out Mossadegh, if we'd encouraged him, if we'd helped him to use Iran's oil money to help the poor people of Iran, that could conceivably have changed the whole history of the Middle East and all the subsequent terrible problems and conflicts that we're now experiencing that are going on there.
I agree. The idea of corrupting a country from within, using its own people, I don't even know a word bad enough to describe that.
Yeah. And, you know, And so often we lay the blame. I hear time and time again, well, the problem with Africa is corrupt leaders. Well, that's somewhat true, but we have to ask ourselves, who corrupted these people? Corruption doesn't grow on trees. Somebody's got to corrupt them. And in case after case after case after case, it's we who do it. It's our economic hitmen. It's our corporations. It's our government who goes in and corrupts the leaders of other countries. And these leaders know that if they don't succumb to the corruption, then the jackals are right there behind them to assassinate them or overthrow them. And they can look at example after example after example where that's happened throughout the world, most of the deck being one of those examples.
We recently had a student here at the Institute from Japan, and he was talking about American politics. He said, why don't you just get rid of Bush? Why are people tolerating this? There's that kind of idea, opinion, I guess would be a good word, opinion about U.S. tactics. You've been around the world. Is this true worldwide, that they just think we're a big bully?
I hear this all the time everywhere. Friday I came back from Ecuador, from South America. And eight countries now in Latin America, representing over 80% of the people of South America, have elected in the most recent democratic election a president who's standing up to the United States, is standing up to the corporatocracy, saying, you know, Ecuador's oil resources ought to help Ecuador's poor people, and Bolivia's gas resources ought to help Bolivia's poor people, etc. And I've been in a number of these countries and over the past 6 months, and as I said, just came back from Ecuador. And in Ecuador, a couple of presidents ago, they elected a president who ran on a ticket that was saying those things, that we're going to stand up to the United States. But after he was elected, the first month he went to Washington, famous pictures of him holding hands with George Bush, came back to Ecuador, and he went against all of his campaign promises. Signed sweet deals with the World Bank and U.S. oil companies. They threw him out of office. And my Ecuadorian friends at the time would call me up and say, why don't you do the same thing? Your president's not standing for what he believes in, for what you elected him for. Why don't you get rid of him? How can you continue like this? And I hear this, Sherry, over and over and over again, that we're not truly a democracy, Our politicians can promise anything they want, and once they're elected, they go ahead and do exactly the opposite, or do whatever they promise what they need in order to get elected, and then they do what they want in order to serve the corporatocracy. And I get this question over and over again: why do you put up with that if you claim to be a democracy?
Well, in looking at what you've done in your books, you've done a lot to undo what you were paid to do as a I can't even describe, as a hitman.
Yeah.
So you're working now to help these countries get back on their feet, and can you describe a little bit of that, of what you're working toward now?
Yeah, well, like I said, I was a hitman for 10 years, and I got out in 1981, and ever since then I've pretty much devoted myself to trying to undo that damage and expose it, and I do a lot of work with nonprofit organizations. That's why I was just in Ecuador with the Pachamama Alliance, which takes over $1 million a year down to help indigenous people in the Amazon fight the oil companies that are destroying their lands in the Amazon. And the Dream Change and a lot of other organizations. Again, you can look at our website, Pachamama Alliance, pachamama.org or dreamchange.org, and writing books and traveling around speaking and going to universities and trying to encourage young people to get out there and change things. We must change things. I deeply believe in this country. And I believe that the people of this country do not want to see what's going on in the world continue. We want change. We want things to get better. And we can make that happen. We've shown time and time again in the past that we have a lot of power as consumers. Well, you know, we get big corporations to clean up rivers that were terribly polluted 20, 30 years ago, get them to get rid of aerosol cans that were destroying the ozone layer, to open their doors wider to blacks and other minorities and women. Got them to get rid of trans fats in their foods like McDonald's and KFC recently has, and to get antibiotics out of chickens like Tyson's recently did. We have tremendous power, and now we need to convince these corporations that they need to move from having a goal of creating huge profits regardless of the environmental and social costs to creating profits but within the context of also doing so by creating a world that's sustainable and stable, peaceful, and socially just.
Well, we have that power here, and we feel like we have freedoms that are constantly being challenged. But one of the things I was impressed with in the book is when you talk about and make very factual statements that if the economic hitmen can't pull this off, they'll send in the troops. Is that what's going on now in Iraq?
Well, exactly. You know, as I mentioned before, when we economic hitmen fail, which isn't too often, but when we fail, then the jackals are sent in to assassinate governments or overthrow them. And when they fail, then as a last resort is the military sent in. And that's what happened in Iraq. We had a huge success in Saudi Arabia in the 70s after the oil embargoes here. I talk about that extensively in Secret History of the American Empire, how I was sent to Saudi Arabia to bring the Saudis around, to corrupt them so we'd never have an oil embargo like that before. And we did. We got them to agree to a number of very, very important things. I think it may have been the most important deal since World War II in geopolitics. And the Saudis agreed to all of it. And then we decided that we needed to do the same thing with Saddam Hussein, who controlled the second largest oil supply in the world after Saudi Arabia. But he wouldn't go along with it. So, for whatever reason. So we sent in the jackals to take him out, but they couldn't. He was very crafty. He'd been a CIA agent. He'd been hired to assassinate the former premier of Iraq, a guy named Qasem, back in 62. And he knew what to do, and he had a lot of lookalike doubles, which was very smart on his part. It was very difficult to take him out, and we couldn't. So we sent the troops in 91. At that point, we wiped out his military, thought he was sufficiently chastised that now he would come around. The economic hitman went back in the 90s, but once again failed, and the jackals again failed. So this time we sent the troops in this last time and took him out. And you know, that serves a huge notice to anybody who's considering standing up to us or standing against us. They know that they can either accept the bribes and get rich and have their family get rich, or they can be taken out by a coup or assassinated, or if for some reason they're able to avoid that, then the military will go in.
We're going to post your websites, and there's a big list in your book about all the people who don't play this game and aren't under control of the government. We're going to post all of those on our website. That's the least we can do to get this out for people. And for some people who can't spell the one site that you just mentioned, we'll put that on there too for the people.
Great. Thank you. And my website is johnperkins.org, which is pretty easy, and it'll take you to all those other ones too.
Okay. That's good. One of the questions, when people heard that you were going to be on the show, one of the things that they've asked me is, in your book, we're making absolutely the point that this is not like a hostile takeover of a company. This is the deliberate economic ruin of an entire string of nations in the name of power for the U.S. And people have felt that there is a threat here in the U.S., with what Bush did in, I think it was March, in writing an executive order that he could take over all businesses and all government and all this if there was any kind of national emergency. And now we're being threatened with this bird flu pandemic, and we're being told that Rumsfeld's company that makes Tamiflu is just raking in the dough because of all of these millions of dollars worth of Tamiflu that the government has purchased from his company, and also that there might be a threat that this bird flu pandemic would be used as an excuse by Bush to declare martial law and take over in the same way in the U.S. that he did in other countries, because it certainly looks like that's what they're starting here.
Well, yeah, you know, our liberties have certainly been curtailed under the Bush administration. This business of creating empires and even an empire within the United States has gone on under both Democrats and Republicans. And I think we need to understand in this election year that although it is important who we vote for, all of the people running are going to ultimately be very beholden to the corporate interests. That's where most of the campaign money comes from. for presidents and for all the Congress people. And so it really ultimately is up to us, you and me and the consumer especially, to realize that we have to send a strong message to corporations, not buy things that are made in sweatshops like at Nike and Walmart, et cetera, and not buy things that are made giving environmental destruction, and send the word out that we're happy that companies make profit, but they've got to do it while buying into a sustainable and socially just principle. And yet, again, I think that under the Bush administration, we've seen our rights terribly, terribly curtailed. It's scary to me, and I'm very struck. Like you said, I spend a lot of time in Latin America. I speak fluent Spanish. And it's been interesting to watch what's gone on in Venezuela, where we've talked about how undemocratic we call Chavez a dictator, et cetera. But he recently had this referendum where part of the thing was that there were no limitations on term of the president. People said that meant that he wanted to be president for life. It didn't necessarily mean that. It meant that he wanted to change the Constitution so you could run for more than a couple of terms. He lost. The referendum went out to the general population, and they voted it down, and he accepted defeat and said he'll step down at the end of his term. Unlike what's gone on in our country with so many recent laws, like the one you just mentioned, the Patriot Act, none of us had the opportunity to vote on those things. Those were rammed through Congress by a very strong administration. And I find something very, very frightening about that, Sherry, that it's not a democratic process at all.
Do you think all this comes down from the president, or someone is controlling the president, or
the president doesn't really have that much power. It's the big corporations. It's what I call the corporatocracy, the men and women who run our biggest corporations. And that includes people who surround the president, like Cheney and Rice and so many others that jump back and forth. So at the very top, you can't tell the difference between corporate heads and the heads of our government, because they're constantly going back and forth between, you know, Rice was high up in Exxon, and Cheney was high up in Halliburton, and Bush himself, the Bush family, is high up in the oil industry. And that's true in Republican regimes, too. So it's the big corporations that really call the shots. They have the money. Nobody gets elected without a lot of money. The estimate is it's going to cost each of the final two candidates for this next presidential race half a billion dollars each. Now, that money is not going to come from you and me or the general citizens. It's going to come through people who make that money through corporations, through stock owning major shares of stock in those corporations, serving on their boards, et cetera.
Of all the people who are running now, who do you think would be the best candidate that we could give our vote to?
You know, for me, it's too soon to tell. At this point in time, I really haven't heard any of them truly addressing the real issues. For example, on immigration, the real issue isn't whether what we do about the laws or build fences or so on. Most of the illegal immigrants in this country don't really want to be here. I speak Spanish. They want to be back in Guatemala or Mexico or El Salvador, wherever they come from. But because of our trade liberalization laws, as we call them, NAFTA and CAFTA and the other ones, we've destroyed the economies of their countries. We're exploiting them so they can't find work there. The real answer to the immigration problem is to build up the economies in those countries so those people can find work there. Nobody's addressing that. The real issue is not Iran or Iraq or terror or Osama bin Laden. The issue is, why is there terrorism? There's terrorism because there's terribly suffering people in the world, starving people, millions of starving people. Every single day, something like 30 million people starve to death around this planet. And that's why we have terrorism. And a few ringleaders like Osama bin Laden take advantage of that. But if we want to create homeland security in this country, then we've got to look at the whole world as our homeland, and we've got to do away with the root causes of dissent, of distress, of unhappiness, of anger, of misery. And nobody's really talking about those things. I'm hoping that we will force them to talk about this, and then the person who really addresses those issues is the one that I'll vote for in the end. Hopefully somebody will.
Well, there's a lot more questions I would like to ask. Your books, has done a lot to wake people up. I want people to rush out and buy them immediately. John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman and the Secret History of the American Empire. We are certainly pleased that you will be able to be with us. Our time is up. If we have another opportunity, we'll go into more depth with you on another show. thank you for being here, and thank you for your attitude about changing our world. We all know that it certainly needs some help.
My pleasure, Sherry, and keep up your great work. It's programs like this that keep democracy alive and that will bring us around to creating a better world. So my hat's off to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And John Perkins is going to drop off the line, and we're going to have a discussion here. He was only able to be with us about 45 minutes. So we have people here who have read his book, and some of the information about Nike Corporation, one of the corporations that we can likely stay away from now, is in his book, The Secret History of the American Empire. Pauline Ward is with us, and she has read that section about what Nike is doing in the sweatshops and that kind of thing. Pauline, would you talk about that particular situation a bit?
Well, to me, it was just one of many horrifying instances that are quoted in the second book. Very, as Sherry said, a very, very readable book. Very enlightening, very devastating. I mean, I'm not an American, but in Australia, we just feel that we're just following along behind America, and that can get rather annoying to us at times. But this is throwing another light on it altogether. A couple went down and to the Nike sweatshop in, I think it was India, and lived that way for 6 months, and was pretty indescribable. Something like a 10x10 concrete floored dwelling with no amenities, just mats to sleep on and not enough food really to eat. If you had a family, it was a choice between feeding your children or yourself at times. Changes were made. Pressure was brought to bear and changes were made, but when John went back a few years later to see it and met some of the original people there, or that couple, they said it hasn't really got better. Yes, we got a wage increase, but petrol's risen, food's risen. We are no better off than what we were. And the hunger that he speaks of, it's devastating if we do stop and think about it. But Sherry, what I'm really thrilled about is that he's given us some tools in the back of that second book, at least, that list all sorts of places, organisations where you can make a difference. And that's what I find really impressive. There's pages that are listed of organisations that are stepping out of this way of working through corporations in that way.
Well, there's a point where we can only blame ourselves because we want to buy Nike. Our kids want it on their feet. And we don't want to pay $200 and $300 for a pair of tennis shoes. And if they were made in America, that's probably how much they would cost. So they send us out to these sweatshops where these people work for $2 a month and they abuse them. But here we go to the store and yet we buy them because they're less expensive. Heather, do you do that with your kids?
It kind of affects me to hear that about Nike. I wasn't aware of that situation, although I had heard rumors. My kids love Nike. I like Nike.
Pauline told me a story about the working conditions, and you can probably tell it better than I can, about the bathroom breaks and what the women had to go through to work in these sweatshops.
Oh, yes, they weren't allowed. I think they allowed two bathroom breaks, and it was probably not an 8-hour day. So they wore scarves and things that draped around their pants, their normal clothing, to hide any blood stains when they were menstruating, because they couldn't go often enough to do what they had to do.
And have to sit there and I mean, how do they control these people? If they take a bathroom break, they take their wages for the day or something?
Don't know. But we just can't believe that those conditions. But coming back to the question, why do we like Nike? Why is it Nike? Is that then just down to advertising? Is it back to watching television? Is it being brainwashed by that make our kids want to have it?
I think it's the advertising. And he says, and you say as a teacher at Steiner School, turn off that television. Go out, take a walk, do something with your kids, anything but the boob tube, because that
sets the stage for what we are buying, and our buying habits are perpetuating what he's trying to get rid of.
Yep, so in the back of that book, places are listed that are not buying into those conditions, and hopefully there'll be many, many, many more pages of those businesses that'll come to the fore and will turn their back on that. Yet it's a tricky thing. At least they're getting an income. So you see, it's a bigger picture than just, that's one thing the individual can do, but as John points out, it's a bigger picture in changing everything.
I don't know if stockholders have any control over what a company does, but certainly we as buyers do. One of the things that he says, so this book is so eloquently written, it's amazing. He talks about the perspective of the indigenous people, and that for the U.S. coming in and taking over, it's a matter of money. But for them, it's a matter of survival of their children and their cultures. And let's see if I can find this quote. He has one about turning the entire thing into a cesspool. I'll find it in a second, but here's just some of the other quotes. Members of a conspiracy, this is one he's talking about, everybody talking about one world order and that kind of thing. That was really, that idea was really created and perpetuated by the CIA so people wouldn't really come after the corporation. They would see it as some unseen one world order that they couldn't do anything about. Members of a conspiracy like that could be brought to justice. This system, however, is fueled by something far more dangerous than conspiracy. It is driven not by a small band of men, but by a concept that has been accepted as gospel. The idea that all economic growth benefits humankind, and that the greater the economic growth, the more widespread the benefits. This belief also has a corollary that these people who excel at stoking the fires of economic growth should be exalted and rewarded, while those born on the fringes are available for exploitation. You know, I can't say enough good about his book, and I'm looking at these other quotes here.
It's very deep. The book, the second book, and I haven't read the first one yet, but I'm really impressed with the detail he goes into, the names he names, places, the experiences he's had. It's a very far-reaching experience. It's not just one or two incidents. There's been a wide, for what, decade, two decades since he stopped? 17 years or something, of trying to change, being part of what he was. And it is very enlivening details for me, very readable. But it's not just one or two incidences. It's widespread.
I like the idea that he took the bribe money and turned it against the people who bribed him. That's why I said at the beginning, you know, I'm surprised you're still alive.
Yeah, he confirmed a thought that I had in my head all along, that President Bush, although he has some power, he has a lot of bigger, more powerful people behind him, like Cheney. I always suspected that.
Well, one of the things I liked about Ron Paul's campaign is he's going to get rid of lobbyists, so all these big companies won't have this kind of clout. I found the cesspool thing. He's describing the ideas of the macaws and jaguars have all but vanished. Indigenous cultures have been driven to the verge of collapse. Pristine rivers have been transformed into flaming cesspools. And one of the questions I wanted to ask him is, isn't there any controls in those countries about what's happened? I wanted to know, too, about how the economic takeover happens step by step. I think if you buy his book, you'll be able to see that. And we are going to put on the website, our website, about his being here, that preface of the book that is so gracefully written. Either he is a master editor, or this is just so from the heart. It's just so believable and just flows. And he didn't really, I guess he named the president as being ultimately responsible. But when we look at who runs the president, then it's going to be corporations and lobbyist groups and that kind of thing. And they really need to get, we really need to force them to get their heads out of their pocketbook. because they're certainly not doing things for us. Again, the name of the book, The Secret History of the American Empire, by John Perkins, P-E-R-K-I-N-S, and Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. And johnperkins.com is his website. Thank you for listening. I hope this has brought some information into your life that is disturbing and life-altering.
All about the Main Street blues. It is cold.